Thank you. A very good morning to all of you. Let me start maybe by saying that I come and I work for an organization for Europe, which is slightly different from the European Union that Professor Chiropoulos described. The Council of Europe is the other, the older, the poorer European institution. It's a classical intergovernmental organization, something like the United Nations. We have 47 member states, and this is a little detail that is important when it comes to intercultural dialogue, because we have member states which are not Christian at all, which have a Muslim population. In fact, five of our member states are Muslim countries, predominantly or partly. It is an intergovernmental organization which has countries like Azerbaijan and Turkey and the Russian Federation, which in terms of policy standards and history and religious composition are very different from the member states of the European Union. So this diversity, which is inbuilt into the Council of Europe, may have helped us to think about intercultural dialogue and may have helped us to develop this document, which is called the White Paper on Intercultural Dialogue. I'll come to that in a minute. I'll make, if you allow me, four comments. One is on the White Paper, a few refresher ideas and some information on the follow-up. I will also make a comment, secondly, on some of the current discussions we are having in the area of multiculturalism and intercultural dialogue. I will then say something on the religious dimension of intercultural dialogue. When reflecting about values, it is logical and unavoidable to also think about religious dimension. And lastly, I would say something on how we see the role of the academic community and of universities in the area of intercultural dialogue. But let me start with the Council of Europe and our work for the White Paper. In fact, the Council of Europe is the international organization which, for the first time, has used the term intercultural dialogue in a legal context. In 1995, our 47 member states, or slightly less than, adopted an international treaty which is called the Framework Convention for the Protection of National Minorities. And in that Framework Convention, we used for the first time the term intercultural dialogue, which should inspire as a principle the relationship between majorities and minorities in a country. This is interesting and I think important to note, because it shows that although we are today more or less used to associate intercultural dialogue with migration processes, there are also other dimensions to intercultural dialogue. And in fact, we first thought about this in the context of national minorities. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, suddenly many European countries found themselves, when the borders were redrawn in the Balkan region, for instance, found themselves in a situation where suddenly there were totally new, old national minorities. And in the 1990s, we had to address very urgently the question of how to relate to these minorities. And that is where the notion of intercultural dialogue came in. The Council of Europe is also an organization which tried immediately after the Second World War to draw the conclusions from the Second World War. In this context of this historical heritage, it was soon the European consensus that our only way forward is to learn to understand the other. To build democratic societies where everybody has a fair chance to participate and to give everyone the rights that belong to every human being. These are, of course, the fundamental values which underpin intercultural dialogue. And they are the fundamental values which today are what we call part of the deep security of Europe, the security that binds us together, that ensures that everyone can participate, and that creates sustainable relations between individuals, cultures, and religions. So my first comment is this, that the white paper which we published in 2008, and which I understand has been the object of previous workshops, this workshop tries to formulate the conclusions from this value basis and to develop ideas on how to take this forward. I will just refresh you by naming the five dimensions in which the white paper tackles this problem. The white paper says, first of all, there must be a democratic governance of cultural diversity. So that is a look towards the legislation, towards the political standards, towards the political institutions in which we live and manage the cultural diversity of Europe. Secondly, intercultural dialogue is dependent on a strong and widespread sense of citizenship and participation for all. Thirdly, intercultural dialogue can only function if all of us, in theory, ideally, have the capacity to live with diversity. And that is, of course, an issue which relates to education, which relates to languages, which relates to knowledge, which relates to formal, non-formal, informal education, which relates to the media and so on. The fourth dimension which we looked at was the necessity to create more and more accessible spaces for intercultural dialogue, be it physical spaces, like institutions, like churches, like universities, schools, kindergartens, social facilities in urban planning and so on, or be it virtual places like media, possibilities for minorities to express themselves in the media and possibilities for majorities to learn about minorities through the media. And finally, fifthly, we looked at the international dimension of intercultural dialogue and tried to formulate the conclusions that follow on from these principles for international actors, be it governmental actors, be it non-governmental actors. Since the adoption of the white paper in 2008, things have moved forward. The European Union in 2008 proclaimed the European Year of Intercultural Dialogue. That was a big help, and it launched a number of very interesting and very forward-looking projects. And still today, we feel this impetus when we talk to the various stakeholders. We in the Council of Europe, we have concentrated on specific issues where we have a certain expertise. First of all, let me give you as an example activities that we do at the local level. We have built up a network of intercultural cities, cities which are not only diverse in themselves, but are also open to this diversity and are ready to reflect about how they can promote this diversity, how they can be more cohesive, how they can more accommodating, how they can benefit from this diversity for the purpose of their own future as a community. We have created a network of cities, two dozen now, which have installed the management structures to deal with this diversity. And our program now supports also national networks of intercultural cities which are active in this area. And I'm happy to say that here in Italy we have one of the two national networks of intercultural cities, and we are following this with a lot of interest. Another example is the work in the field of media. It is obvious that media have a particularly important role to play in the intercultural dialogue. We have started in 2009 a campaign with training institutions for young journalists in order to develop the standards in the journalism training that allow young journalists to be aware of their specific role in the context of intercultural dialogue and to look at examples of good practice. Nobody wants to tell journalists what they should think or what they should do, but we think it's important that certain standards are at least available in journalism training in order to make young journalists aware that they have a particularly important role. A third example that I could quote here is in the education systems. Here we have, since the publication of the white paper, we have developed numerous training modules together with ministries of education and teachers that look at the various aspects of intercultural dialogue, democratic citizenship, human rights education, multi-perspectivity in history teaching is an important issue for us, media literacy, prevention of crimes against humanity, and so on and so on. This is one of the areas where the Council of Europe certainly is in the driver's seat internationally, also with regard to other international institutions. We have a similar role in the area of youth policy, where we are currently developing a project which looks at one particular aspect which creates a lot of headaches, and that is hate speech and discrimination on the internet. And together with youth organizations, we are currently developing a project which is called Human Rights Defenders Online, where we try to train young people to defend themselves and to defend the internet against hate speech and the incitation to violence. And yet all of these projects and programs, and I could quote many more, obviously have a limited impact. We have, sadly enough, a situation where the results of such programs, and the European Union runs parallel programs, and we are also cooperating in many areas, but all of these programs are very slow to trickle down to the grassroots and to address these problems effectively. There are many worrying signs today. There are many political campaigns and political decisions to reduce individual and collective freedoms, which result from the fear of cultural diversity. And some political forces in Europe today are exploiting the existing anxieties for political ends. We are witnessing the emergence of new nationalism in many European countries, which emphasize through public policies the national cultural canon at the expense of intercultural dialogue. These tendencies, in our view, could turn out to be extremely counterproductive and to threaten the progress that we have made in recent years. The Secretary General of my organization, Torbjørn Jagland, said recently, "We are witnessing a process that weakens the culture of togetherness that we helped build after the war. A cold wind is blowing over Europe." And we have to take this seriously. We would fail, of course, miserably if we allowed xenophobia, exclusion, discrimination, and segregation to get the upper hand. Now, in this situation, and this is my second comment, the Council of Europe has come back to the issue of intercultural dialogue and has asked what we call a group of eminent persons under the chair of the former German Foreign Minister, Joschka Fischer, to look at these tendencies and to advise the international community on the current problems of intolerance and discrimination and to make proposals how to take this forward. And this report, which was published just before the summer break, which looks like this, Living Together, Combining Diversity and Freedom in 21st Century Europe, which I recommend to your attention. This report, in fact, looks at some of the current issues. So it goes further than the white paper. It takes positions also with regard to very detailed day-to-day political issues. The report identifies a number of risks to the cohesion of Europe and risks to the value basis of Europe in terms of cultural diversity. These risks are rising intolerance, rising support for xenophobic and populist parties, discrimination, the presence of populations without rights, virtually without rights, like the Roma communities or irregular migrants, the emergence of parallel societies, Islamic extremism, the loss of democratic freedoms based on the questionable assumption that security and civil liberties are somehow at odds with each other, and the possible contradictions between religious freedom and the freedom of expression. Now, when you read this report, you will find not everything is maybe the last word that would ever be said on these issues, but this report certainly takes a very principled stand on the value basis that underpins intercultural dialogue and the need, the political requirements that follow on from that. Our member states, our 47 member states, are currently in the process of drawing the conclusions from this report. And it will not surprise you when you hear that when 47 governments sit together with 47 governments of very different political affiliations and colors, they will arrive at widely different conclusions when it comes to sensitive issues like intercultural dialogue. And that is where we are currently in the middle of this process. However, we are certain that our common values, embodied and protected by the European Convention on Human Rights, will give us a common basis for action. Let me give you, in this context, one example of the current debate. Earlier this year, in his address to the 2011 Munich Security Conference, Prime Minister Cameron of the United Kingdom spoke about the role of terrorism. And one of the underlying reasons, he said, for terrorism is that under the, and here I quote, under the doctrine of state multiculturalism, we have encouraged different cultures to live separate lives, apart from each other and apart from the mainstream. We have failed to provide a vision of society to which they want to belong. End of quote. Mr. Cameron is, of course, not alone in this forceful criticism. in many parts, in fact, politicians express their misgivings about the slow or failing integration of migrants and of other minorities. Terrorism may be the most terrifying aspect, but ghettos, educational failure, unemployment, discrimination, marginalization, mutual stereotyping, they are all widespread symptoms of the same problem. And only a few weeks back, we were also reminded of the fact that this is not a problem of migration alone. This type of terrorism, which is jeopardizing the social cohesion and the value basis of European societies, can also be tacked from within, from parallel societies that exist in the midst of our own societies. I'm of course talking about the events in Norway. Now, this being said, and I come back to multiculturalism and the current criticism of multiculturalism, it is important to distinguish, and Mr. Cameron in his speech did that, in all fairness, which was sometimes forgotten in the press, to distinguish between two notions. The multicultural composition of our societies, the multiculturality, we called it in the white paper, which is an undisputable fact throughout Europe in all 47 of our member states, on the one hand, and the policy approach of multiculturalism on the other. We have made this distinction very clear in this white paper, and we have underlined that multiculturalism is an outdated and insufficient concept based on a schematic or position between majorities and minorities, and a concept which endorses separation instead of dialogue and interaction. This, I think, is very important to keep in mind when looking at some of the current discussions. In the white paper, instead of multiculturalism, we have said we need interculturalism. We need an interculturalist approach. And the other day, reading a text of Pope Benedict the 16th, which he wrote before he became Pope, it was very interesting to note that he used in 2005 already this term, interculturalist approach, exactly the same term. And this leads me to the third comment I would like to make, and that is the religious dimension of intercultural dialogue. Now, I work for an intergovernmental organization, and it is part of the European model of society that there's some kind of autonomy between religion on the one hand and politics and the state on the other. In fact, one could define this European model with three basic principles. One is the freedom of religion. One is the equal obligations and responsibilities of everybody, regardless of religious affiliation. And the third one is a certain degree of autonomy between religious organizations and the public sphere. Now, the Council of Europe, and together with us, most if not all intergovernmental institutions, at least in Europe, have had a relatively distanced relationship with religion over many years. Religion for us, for the Council of Europe, for instance, played a role only under two aspects. One is the freedom of religion, and the other one is religion as part of the cultural heritage. Now, freedom of religion, you all know this, Article 9 of the European Convention on Human Rights says everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, which includes the freedom to change this religion or belief, and to, of course, and to have no religion at all. This principle of religious freedom has led to numerous follow-on principles, the principle of non-discrimination on human grounds among them, which can be found in many international conventions. For instance, when you look at cyber criminality, on nationality, on adoption rights, on even in terms of mutual recognition of educational diploma, on the legal status of migrant workers and so on. In all these conventions, it is necessary to say you must not discriminate on religious grounds, also not on other grounds, but not on religious grounds. The second aspect for many years where we looked at religion was the cultural heritage, but there are very few operational programs were run, and very few clear statements can be found in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And these two issues, religious freedom and the cultural heritage, they are, of course, important, but they do not capture the entire reality of religious belief, the religious reality of Europe in the sense of the values that hold us together. The Council of Europe has denied dialogue with religious communities for a long time. One may interpret this as an expression of abstentionist laïcité, as the experts call it. A strict neutrality of the state that is marked by a certain suspicion and by non-dialogue. That, I think, has been the reality for many years. And it's only recently that the Council of Europe, and under the impact of the need to look at intercultural dialogue, that the Council of Europe has begun to deal with religion and religious communities in a more political way. In 2005, the heads of state and government of the Council of Europe came together, and for the first time in the history, they acknowledged that there is a religious part of our common history, of our common heritage, and there is a need to systematically encourage intercultural and interfaith dialogue based on universal human rights as a means of promoting awareness, understanding, reconciliation, and tolerance, as well as preventing conflicts and ensuring integration and the cohesion of society. For the first time in 2005, you find this in an international text here in Europe. Some years before, the Council of Europe published a text on cultural diversity in 2000, and not once is there an acknowledgement of religion and religious heritage and religious belief as part of the cultural diversity. Now, what follows on from this insight, the Council of Europe has tried to implement this in some very modest but groundbreaking activities. The first Commissioner on Human Rights ran a very interesting series of debates for the first time, where he invited the big religious communities traditionally present in Europe and invited them for a dialogue on questions like, what can religious communities contribute to peace and reconciliation? How can the mutual understanding between cultures be promoted by them? How is the relationship between religion and state to be organized? The Committee of Ministers, the member states, since that date have started to organize exchanges on the religious dimension, where we look at issues like the role of religious media for intercultural dialogue, or questions like information on religious matters in school, not religious instruction, but the teaching of religious facts in school. And this is something to which the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe attaches a lot of importance. The significance and the role of religious communities are therefore recognized much more strongly today than this has been the case in the past. And of course, we realize that the aims of intercultural dialogue can only be achieved together with religious communities, not against them. And this, of course, can only work if religious communities are ready to dialogue. Let me stop with a fourth comment, and that is a very brief comment on the role of the academic community. A few months ago, we were invited to a conference of the newly established International Institute for the Alliance of Civilizations of the United Nations University in Barcelona. On this occasion, the coordinator for intercultural dialogue of the Council of Europe, Mrs. Patrini Dragoni, where we met, said, "We know some things about culture, education, and youth, but we need to know much more. We need to share this knowledge with more people. And knowledge is only one dimension. We also need to build up intercultural competencies, not only among the elites, but as widely as possible." Now here, I think we are trying to express that higher education has an obvious and important role to play in this policy. Learning and teaching intercultural competencies are part of the core business of higher education. Beyond the competences that higher education will give learners in their specific field of study, higher education must give all graduates a set of generic competences if they are to meet today's academic, political, cultural, and economic requirements. And these competencies include analytical ability, communication skills, and the ability to make decisions on the basis even of incomplete information. And these competencies include crucial intercultural competencies. And just to name three of them, languages, understanding of history, and preparation for life as active citizens in democratic societies. All three competencies are crucial for the success of intercultural dialogue. In view of these essential functions for society, it would be unthinkable that higher education and research are not fully engaged in the promotion of cultural diversity and the teaching and learning of intercultural skills. We need to know about other cultures, but we also need to understand them, and we need to be able to act on this knowledge and understanding, to be able and willing to conduct intercultural dialogue, not only as an academic exercise, but also in daily practice. And this is where you, the academic community of the University of Padua, have an important role to play. Thank you very much.